I crave novelty, and I have a very low tolerance for personal stagnation. So my personal like saying is that I am a person who's seeking superlatives. And so if I feel like I'm not doing my best or I can't do my best in a role, I will seek the thing that makes me feel like I'm doing that. And so I'm never afraid to let go of something that isn't serving me to find the next thing. And it was painful early in my career. I mean, very painful to be in these situations and feel like it wasn't working. And like, you know, I'm sure we've all been here running up against management or against the person that you perceive to be in your way. And it's like, no, you're just not in the right place. Like, you've outgrown this show.
I'm Renee Vaughan Sutherland, and welcome to Greater Than 11%, a weekly podcast that explores roles and opportunities within the creative industries, with the aim of contributing to increasing diversity across the board, in addition to promoting some awesome women.
For episode 58, we are joined by data and transformation strategy leader, Jennifer Clark. In her current role, Jen's remit is wide and reaching. It involves her using her experience to transform businesses, leveraging her knowledge in strategy, marketing, digital, change management for data and creative heavyweight, MRM, McCann. But she didn't start her career focusing on strategy and transformation. Her undergraduate degree was in printmaking. But then she decided to switch it up and did her master's in public policy analysis at Carnegie Mellon University, going on to land a role as an operations analyst at the Art Institute once she graduated. The organization, based in Pittsburgh, assists creatives needing support and funding for their education. She continued learning and growing her skill set, moving on to become a digital strategist and product manager, whilst also freelancing as a strategist in digital marketing and media for the banking, health, and retail sectors. And if juggling those two roles wasn't enough, she brought her strategic thinking and her creative talents together and founded The Glitter Games, which provided events, tools, and services to help people lead happier and more creative lives. To quote Jen, you can think of the Glitter Games, day-long crafting events, as a tough mudder for crafting. As the company's chief creative officer, or, as she preferred to be called, the unicorn incarnate, she ran the company for 5.5 years, focusing on its mission to be a human creative accelerator. In 2016, she secured a business strategy customer experience director role at MRM McCann's New York office. Her focus was on customer experience, CX, for large private and government organizations. In 2018, the opportunity to apply for her current role, data and transformation strategy practice leader for McCann in the UK, came up, and she jumped at the chance and swapped the bustle of NYC for the quirks of London. Jen always seems to be learning and picking up new skills. Last year, she received a certificate in marketing and social media analytics from MIT Sloan School of Management, as well as a creative strategy certification from Facebook. She speaks French and German, and was a Wacko 2019 Future Leaders Award winner. Jen, I'm super looking forward to discussing your varied career path and all the incredible things you juggle. Welcome to Greater Than 11%.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. It's really jarring to hear that all played back, but also exciting. And I was like, wow, whose resume is this? I love this person. I wish, oh wait, that's my resume.
It's awesome. Yeah. What I love about it is it's like so varied. I love this notion that you studied printmaking and then just switched it over and did kind of public policy analysis. It's incredible.
Yeah, it's not as big a leap as it seems. And so I still passionate about the arts, love art. But what I really went to school for was arts management, and it's in the public policy school. And so it's the same skill set. It was essentially an MBA for running public institutions.
Got it.
So that's kind of what led to my career. So it's not obvious if you look at it, but yeah, so there was a heavy emphasis still on arts and cultural institutions in the program I went to.
Cool. I'm going to come back to that for sure. Mm-hmm. But if we can start off with you telling me what exactly it is a data and transformation strategy leader does.
Well, I love trying to explain to people what any strategist does, and it's basically I think for a living, which is a really good feeling. But I'll get into the specifics. So data strategy for me is really about understanding the data that you need to fuel creativity. And so whether that's targeting, whether that's customer insights that can only come from owned data. And so by owned data, I mean data held within a company's database. So those things that we know about people. It's about using those kinds of things to fuel creativity or to change the organization. Because my background is in CX, really passionate about people, what makes them tick, what motivates them. And that's sort of at the center of that practice. And the same thing with transformation. It's about helping them help people better in the end.
Yeah, it's quite deep though, isn't it? So you take loads of data and then you're trying to create something that will transform either their experience or the organization and the way they deliver a service or experience.
Yeah, 100%. And that's it. And so at McCann, we're all about meaningful brands. So at the McCann level, it's meaningful brands. And at the MRM level, so we're a tiered organization, it's about meaningful relationships with people. So in order to build those meaningful relationships, you have to know people. Mm. And the best tool you have that have to do that is their data. And so data doesn't always mean implicit data. And by implicit data, I mean behavioral data. So right now in the industry, there's a lot of talk about data points you pick up and what do you infer about something somebody does on the website or what they choose not to do on the website. But I'm also a big fan of what we call voice of the customer programs in CX. Mm-hmm. So voice of the customer is really about just asking people or looking at text linguistic data that they've given you explicitly. Mm-hmm. And so what do you think about this? Asking an open-ended question gives you a breadth of insight that you yourself can't think of. And so when you do data work, it's always best to start with a very broad aperture and then drill that down. And I'll give an example because I know that's fairly abstract, but we were working on a project for electric vehicles and that's now launched with Vauxhall. And we wanted to know, you know, what drove electric vehicle purchase. So we asked people. One of the things we didn't expect to find was the fact that people conflate electric vehicles with autonomous vehicles. Like they think of them as the same thing because they're both in the news at the same time. And that's the kind of thing that sitting in the room with other strategists, you'd never assume.
Yeah, those assumptions are so interesting as well. On the client side, well, on the customer side, but also the assumptions of when you're thinking about strategy, not being able to separate what you believe people might think.
Oh, it's impossible. Yeah, that's our favorite thing to do as marketers is to, quote unquote, put ourselves in the shoes of real people, but to not actually talk to real people. It's a really bizarre thing that's like I'm passionate about fighting all the time where people are like, well, you know, can we find this data point in the database? And it's just like, just ask someone and then I'll confirm it with data. But like ask first. Mm-hmm. So data is really good for proving or disproving assumptions. So if you think about statistics, it's all about the null hypothesis. I'm sure someone listening knows what that means. So the null hypothesis is the theory that in the thing you're searching for, there is no effect, right? And so you either accept or reject the hypothesis. And so a lot of what we do is about that.
Okay. And when you say you talk to people, can you give us an example of the ways that you talk to people?
Oh, for sure. Talking to people isn't fair, it's listening. Mm-hmm. And so it's setting up the research mechanisms to get them to give you a lot of information. And so I work a lot with our UX practitioners on this. We're doing a really interesting project right now. We're doing something called The Letters. Mm-hmm. I was sort of inspired by time I spent at Wilderness. Wilderness is a festival here in the UK. And then time I spent doing UX research. And so basically you get people to write love and breakup letters to a brand or a product. And in that linguistic data, there is a tremendous wealth of insights, but you don't just read through it. We put that data through sometimes it's not even as sophisticated as an algorithm, but through an AI tool or a NLP, which is natural language processing tool, and it'll help you pick out themes that are common across the different pieces of text data you're looking at, and then you can quantify them. So you can say, actually, 16% of people liked this one thing about a product, or 20% of people didn't, you know, mention just this word in their response, which is pretty cool.
Oh my God, I love that concept of writing love and a breakup letter to a brand.
Mm.
We've all been there.
Yeah.
Okay. So you've already shed some light on it. And I mean, you're super passionate about what you do. But for those kind of outside the kind of data and the transformation creative roles, it could be perceived as dry, the role. And I'm wondering, can you discuss how creativity comes into what you do?
We're an enabler of creativity, and I also work directly with creatives on something we call data creativity. So one of my favorite campaigns I've seen recently that ran at Cannes, you know, when you work in advertising, it's like the work I wish I'd done. So there's a really great campaign called Go Back to Africa, mm-hmm. Which is a really ugly phrase that people use, especially in social media, to denigrate people of color. And so they created an experience where they could identify that word in tweets or in text and then target ads for going to Africa, like actually visiting the country, these like really fun and beautiful tourism ads. So turning something really ugly into something really beautiful. And I think increasingly data is becoming a part of our day-to-day lives. One of my other favorite campaigns is the Spotify campaigns that everyone knows. It's like to the guy who played Sorry 42 times on Valentine's Day, what did you do? And so, you know, part of my job is finding those kinds of insights, which are going to make the creative feel personal and interesting.
I loved that Go Back to Africa campaign. It was so smart and so simple. It's so effective because it's so simple.
Yeah, absolutely. And so when people hear data, they immediately think of ones and zeros in spreadsheets. And it's most of it isn't that. It's just thinking about what people are doing and the information that leaves behind. One of the richest sources of data is location data. So where you go can tell us a lot about you. So just think about what you do in a day, where you go to work. Just based on where you go to work, we can probably make some assumptions about you, whether you work in a city or in a rural area. Where you live can tell us your level of affluence. It's kind of scary, actually, now that I'm saying it out loud. Never give anyone your location data unless you want them to know everything about you. But things like that. And it gives you this richness into the insights of the lives of people. Mm. And I think because of companies like Cambridge Analytica, it all feels very sinister. But most brands just want to serve you better. Mm. They just want to make life better for you. And I think that it's up to us as practitioners to always have those kinds of things in our hearts. So the ethics, you know, of what we do becomes important.
Yeah, for sure. We touched upon it when we kicked off, but maybe could you tell us, going back to when you started your career studying printmaking, and then kind of give us a kind of whirlwind tour up until now?
Oh, amazing. Yeah, I can. It's been a long, odd trip, hasn't it? And so, I've always been interested in the arts. I love creativity. And so I went to school for printmaking, which is even fairly esoteric among the arts, which apparently, now that I say this out loud, a recurring theme in my career. I'm like, what's the oddest thing that I can do that's adjacent to the thing everyone knows? Printmaking is... it's really this Zen process that isn't entirely different from data analysis, where it's sort of very process-driven, where, you know, the first thing you do is start with a concept and an idea, then you sketch that idea, then you refine the plate. You know, 70% of data analysis is just refining data and getting to a state that it's useful. Only about 20% of it is then analyzing it, and 10% is presentation, and printmaking is just like that. 70% is preparing a plate, getting into a state. 20% is actually running that plate through a press, and then the last stage is like making it presentable to humans. So it came quite natural to make that transition. And the way I made that transition is I went to school for printmaking, left, and then felt like I wanted to have like a more control over the creative process and sort of what was happening in the creative world. So I went to school for arts management, and I went to Carnegie Mellon, which is known for two things: the arts in its purest form and computer science. And what they don't tell you is that if you go to Carnegie Mellon, you're going to learn to code something. Everybody that goes there, no matter what they study, learns computer programming or coding to some degree. And what I learned was database design. So I actually learned how to design databases and build databases. And that led to a career in operations management. So it was, you know, quantitatively rigorous. I didn't expect that. And in fact, this is my favorite part of that. I was remediated. All the art students, so they accept a lot of art students. So all the art students who get into the, not all, this isn't fair to the others, just in case anyone listens to this, that went to my program, but about 70% of art students are remediated because it's so rigorous. And so I had a summer program where I had to take statistics and economics because it wasn't a part of my degree program, but you sort of take to it like a duck takes the water, or you don't. And so that's the test. It's like either you're going to like this or you're not. And if you don't like it, you probably shouldn't go to school here. But I loved it. And then that led to a career in operations at the art institutes because I still wanted to stay close to the art. But it was so abstract that I was like, I'm going to go make money and be a consultant.
Yeah.
and that's how I ended up being a business analyst and a product manager and doing all that kind of work. But that longing kicked in where I felt like I wasn't close enough to creativity. So I actually left and founded a company, which is now the Glitter Games, but it wasn't the Glitter Games at first. So there was a name change and a rebrand, classic pivot. I sold art online as part of something called docent.co. Mm-hmm. So the original mission of the company was to help people build their own art collections. Like, so for the novice, where could I begin? And it was a subscription model. And too early, actually. So I feel like, do I want to tell everyone this? Somebody's going to go do this idea now. But it's like, you know, if you do, hopefully you get rich, because now VCs are starting to fund these kinds of companies, but they weren't at the time when I was doing it. So basically, you'd subscribe at a certain tier, and every month you subscribed, you were building a pot of money that you'd use then to purchase a piece of art that was meaningful to you. And each month you'd get postcards from artists, and those postcards would help you build your taste, which I really loved doing that. I didn't make any money, so I had to go get a job where somebody else paid me. And that's how I got into McCann, which I took one of these career tests, and it was like, you know, you're creative, but also you have business acumen, you should be in advertising. Mm-hmm. And that's where the love affair began.
Wow. When I was like going through it, it definitely was a shift. Like, I loved the Glitter Games, and I was like, wow, Glitter Games to McCann. That's a massive like Pivot.
Well, So when I couldn't sell any art anymore, I pivoted the company so that it was something I could do in my spare time. Mm-hmm. And so living in New York, I was really a part of the festival scene and like crafting for festivals. A lot of my friends go to Burning Man, so it's like making costumes and things like that. And doing that on scale, I figured, you know, you can make a business out of this. Mm-hmm. And so that I do a lot less of that now, unfortunately, because, you know, the data transformation work takes up so much of my time. But mm-hmm. with friends, you know, not for money, I still hold massive crafting sessions and painting sessions, which is good. I think it's important. So much of our lives is a forgetting. I love English romantic poetry. So this idea of a sleep and forgetting. Like mm-hmm. kids get it. A kid will pick up a crayon and just draw whatever they want. They don't worry if it looks good. They don't worry that someone's going to like it or not like it. And as adults, because so much of our life is performance-based and based on various kinds of judgment, whether that's like, did you do a good job or not a good job, you lose that. Mm-hmm. And that spirit of experimentation and play needs to be part of our lives. So that's mm-hmm. why I do that.
That's such an important point. I think especially any creative, they go, like I definitely went through that cycle of everything I was making was for other people to see mm. and not making for myself. And then when I kind of worked out, oh, I'm just going to do this for myself, I was so happy again. And, you know, then the byproduct is you can give it to people or people really like it and you can sell it or whatever. But yeah, it took me a while to get my head around that.
It can't be the thing. So money and success or approval can never be the outcome. They're a natural byproduct of passion, of being passionate about something. And actually, I was talking to someone recently about this experience I went through on Friday. It was really intense. So basically, I went to this career workshop, didn't know what it was going to be about, but the culminating event is you go through this experience where you meditate through your own death and rebirth.
Oh my God, that's full on. Oh. If you didn't know you were going to it.
Yeah, no. Well, there's other exercises leading up to it, and that's the culminating exercise. And so they ask, you know, do you want to stay or do you want to go? Because this is what's about to happen. Okay. Like people do cry. Yep. It's intense. And so you're in a doctor's office, you've gotten bad news, and I won't get into it. God forbid anybody listening to this cries. After that, it reinvigorated that sense of purpose in me and that understanding that, yeah, like you only have so much time here and what are you going to use your energy doing? Are you going to use your energy worrying about, you know, these trivial things like what other people think or like money, like past what you need to survive? And it's like, it doesn't, you know, you always have to serve your highest intention. Mm. And most of the things that we end up worrying about are not our highest intention. Like the email that gets on your nerves, definitely not your highest intention. So it's like letting that stuff go and then shifting toward what really matters.
So I really love this notion of like your highest intention, because I often think about that. Like it's being mindful, isn't it? Like, don't get wound up about that. What's the point? You're wasting all this energy and it's so trivial. So that was last week, you said?
Yeah, this past Friday.
Okay, what has happened since then? Because you're saying it's so transformational.
So transformational. So, you know, the thing, when you wake up from this experience, you quickly write down, you scroll down everything that you were going to do with that last year of you. So I didn't give you the time frame, but you have 1 year in mm-hmm. your life. And so what are you going to do in that year? And so this isn't any, you wouldn't have seen that, but I wrote a book called The Full English. It's a romantic comedy. Wow. And so step one for me is like querying agents, and I have been querying, but I sort of stopped for like 6 months because work got in the way. And so I'm going to start querying right away, just focusing more on my family and being appreciative of them. Mm. And the same thing, you get annoyed, you get, you know, you feel, and it's like, that doesn't matter. It's like the time you spend with them, the love you have with them. In my career, asking for what you want. And so I always talk about the universe. I'm one of those people, just bear with me, but the same message will be given to you over and over again. And right before I went to that workshop, I use something called Insights Timer, and I do a daily meditation, and the meditation that day was about asking for what you want. And so I set up a meeting immediately with the VP I want to talk to about the thing I want to do next. So it really lit a fire under me.
Wow, that's awesome.
Yeah.
Okay, so I obviously did not know about the book because it's not out there, but tell me about the book. I want to know more about this.
So, you know, we've all been young and in love. And I, you know, I went through this thing where I was like absolutely in love with this person and, you know, it didn't work out in the end. Spoilers. That's not what the book is about, but I needed a way to work through those feelings. Mm-hmm. And I've always, in addition to like being a printmaker, written. And so I started writing this book, and it's about this girl named Dinah who meets a guy at a music festival, and he's British and she's American, and they spend one amazing night together in New York, but are torn apart. And mm-hmm. so it's about their story of trying to get back together.
I can see it as a feature film, Hollywood.
Everyone says that.
Yeah. Yes. Like, yeah. Cool. Oh, well, I look forward to that. So let us know when it comes out and we'll push it out on our social channels. Yeah. That's awesome. So you've explored many different roles in your career. So strategist, creative director, data, transformation. Are you curious by nature, or was it always your intention to take career leaps and switch it up?
I wasn't, but I have a very, I crave novelty, and I have a very low tolerance for personal stagnation. So my personal, like, saying is that I am a person who's seeking superlatives. And so if I feel like I'm not doing my best or I can't do my best in a role, I will seek the thing that makes me feel like I'm doing that. And so I'm never afraid to let go of something that isn't serving me to find the next thing. And it was painful early in my career. I mean, very painful to be in these situations and feel like it wasn't working and like rack your brain for like, how can I make, I want to do this thing. And then you're like, you know, I'm sure we've all been here running up against management or against the person that you perceive to be in your way. And it's like, no, you're just not in the right place. Like you've outgrown this shell. And we all get to that point where, you know, you're just butting up against the edges of the thing you do. And then once you got out of that shell, it's up to you to move. Otherwise you'll wither or you'll become complacent. It's the thing that terrifies me the most is complacency. I always say my spirit totem is Serena Winfrey, which is not a real person, but a combination of Serena Williams and Oprah Winfrey. So the ferocity of Serena Winfrey at her best, I mean, sorry, Serena Williams at her best, with the spiritual grace and serenity of Oprah, which is an interesting tension that I explore.
I like that, Serena Winfrey.
Yeah.
I'm going to think about who I can bring together. So in your role, is there a typical day for you?
No, there's no typical day. I think the typical day is that it's atypical. You have to be ready to take what's thrown at you. When I came here, I was telling you, I got thrown on a plane to Switzerland. I came into work and they're like, we need you in Switzerland tomorrow. And I tried to get out of it and they were like, no one else can go. And it's like, this is within your wheelhouse. Can you please do this? And so, you know, I had to get on a plane and leave, which is like kind of a great feeling, but also terrifying. And so, but I think in my day-to-day, I do a lot of mapping, which is central customer experience work. So I do all kinds of maps to make, you know, the complexity of a human being or their experience accessible to everyone else. So that's probably the thing I do the most. So I have a personal board. I don't know if you have a personal board, but it was one of the things that was recommended to me when I started building my career. It's like, just like companies have a board, people need personal boards. And so I was talking to my board about my career, where I need to go next, off the back of this purpose. I cried like half the weekend because of this conversation about purpose and dying, you know, obviously. And so I called my board and I was like, you know, I need to, what do I need to do next? And they were saying, you know, you go through different stages in your career. And when you're very junior, it's about your work, right? And your relationship with your work. When you're a manager, it's, is my team performing, you know? And then, you know, at the level I'm at, like sort of director, VP, it's, you're trying to solve the problems of the company. And then above that, you're trying to solve the problems of the industry. And so I spend a lot of time just thinking about the ways we do our work and can we do our work better and how do the products and services we offer got into the world, are they actually serving clients? Are they serving, again, that highest intention of bringing humans in the room and providing valuable insight to our creative teams and to the client?
Quite busy then.
Yeah.
Yes. And it sounds like it can just change as well. You're focused on one thing and probably doing a deep dive and then all of a sudden you need to get on a plane to Switzerland.
Something comes up, yeah, and then you sort of have to shift that work. And I'm so grateful to have a team and to be surrounded by people who are understanding and accommodating. It takes that. I think the more senior you get in your career, the more reliant you are on others to support you. Mm-hmm. And I'm grateful to most of the time the support I need.
It's great to have a board as well. There's nothing like, well, literally like a sounding board where you can just bounce things off. I don't have a board. I have like a couple of friends, but yeah, I'd like a board.
Build a board. Yeah.
Cool. So what skills do you need to be a data and transformation strategy leader?
I think you need analytical skills, creative skills, and strategic skills. And so I'll break down what that means. The easiest and most accessible for all of us is creativity. And I don't mean creativity like being a creative in an agency. That's a different skill set. But I mean a natural curiosity about things, an ability to think laterally, so to see connections in things that aren't obvious to others. So that's, I think, a skill that's not everyone has developed, but it's a muscle that's accessible to all of us. Like I was saying earlier, it's something you do innately as a child that you forget to do. So if you can learn and remember to do that again, you're well on your way. Strategic thought is about frameworks and being able to build mental frameworks to make sense of a world that's complex and disordered. And then the analytical part is just being able to, it's not easy. Actually, it does require a degree of creativity, but it's taking structured information and extracting meaning from it. So a good example of that is in that EV, electric vehicle survey I mentioned earlier. If, you know, there are 46 comments that you read, you don't know there are 46 of them, but you keep seeing the word seating over and over again. So it's knowing how to take a spreadsheet and then quantify that and build a, you know, a macro or a formula that quantifies for you that. So it's quite like nuts and bolts, and then being able to make meaning out of that. So it's putting together different pieces of a puzzle to do that kind of work. And I think the further you go in your career, everyone who's good at what they do is good at that. So it doesn't matter what you do in an agency or in a company. I think people who are successful are people who are able to do two things. One, bring disparate pieces of information together to make something new, and then to bring people into that and make it easy for them to understand.
Yeah, it sounds like as well, like you said, there's a lot of lateral kind of thinking as well, constantly thinking about in different ways and flipping things over to make sure that you haven't kind of gone down one route, which ignoring something else as well.
One of my mentors is also on my board, and that's the one thing he compliments me on all the time is my ability to think laterally. And yeah, I don't know. It's just, I think we all have gifts. And when you get recognition for those gifts, that's like, it's a good, good sign that you might be moving in the right direction. Mm. And by recognition, I don't mean that like money or fame. It's like somebody's like, oh, it's like, you're good at this. And you're like, I am. But somebody told me something really interesting recently, which has been a great gift to me. And I've been spreading it all around. So I think this is a good place to do it. And it's about the stages you go through in your career. So the first part of your career is about performance. Can I do this job? Am I good at these things? And building that muscle, just like you would at a gym. So you do that over and over again until it's light work. So this is easy. And the second part of your career, and they overlap, is about how you behave. Can I walk into work and not have a meltdown? Can I not react to this email that annoys me and control my energy and to bring the kind of energy, project the kind of energy to others that, you know, I want them to project? So that's the second part of your career. And the third part is about exposure. So seeking recognition for your work, which is very hard for women. So I went to this workshop. I was at Web Summit, and Google ran this workshop called I Am Remarkable, which was wonderful. But one of the findings they had was that women, and this is actually on the internet, you can bring this into your own company, which is really cool. But women don't seek promotion. And in general, both men and women don't like women who self-promote. So the exposure part, it doesn't come naturally to me, but it's something that I'm working on. And
Yeah, I really like that you said like a couple of times already, like, oh yeah, I'm really good at that. And I'm like, yeah, that's great. I love that you're saying that, because that feels quite foreign for women, I think.
Oh, big time. Yeah. But it's a learned behavior. It's been a learned behavior for me, just acknowledging those things in myself and having confidence in them. Yeah.
Oh, I loved it. I loved hearing you say it. It really buoyed my heart. I was like, yes, that's great. Serena Winfrey's here. So what advice would you give someone considering working in business transformation?
Business transformation is build up your resiliency and don't expect too much.
You're really selling it.
It's all about the small wins. Yeah. And so I think, especially early in my career, I wanted to make a big impact. It's like, I'm going to do this thing and it's going to change. I'm going to change the world with the spreadsheet. It doesn't happen that way. It takes a lot of people to drive change. It takes a lot of consensus and it takes time. And so I think, you know, knowing those things, it gives you patience. And so patience is probably the most important thing you need to do business transformation.
So what has been one of the biggest challenges you faced in your career?
Self-efficacy. And so when you just mentioned, like, you know, me saying I am good at this and feeling that I'm good at this, so like overcoming or at least accepting that imposter syndrome is just a part of life, but it's not real. So being able to separate that from reality, and then also not projecting and internalizing the things other people say or do, which aren't about you. I think the most important thing you can do in your career is being able to separate what's real and not what's not real, especially when you start talking about imposter syndrome. And so when somebody says to you something like, oh wow, it's like good job, and you sort of infer, like, for someone at your level of seniority, because that's the tone in their voice, if that is what they meant, that's about them and not you. And what you should focus on is how you performed and what you brought to the table. Yeah, it's a hard thing to do. And it's taken a lot of time.
I'm so pleased though that you have made that conscious step to do it, because I think the more we see each other doing it, the more we all start taking it on board.
Yeah, a lot of tears, like very real tears, a lot of not going after things because I didn't feel I was good enough. And it's like, you have literally nothing to lose. Like, the worst someone can say to you is no, like, I'm not going to promote you, or I'm not going to do this. But if you don't ask, you know, there's a great saying, it's that closed mouths don't get fed. So you've got to like speak up. And that is, again, hard to do. But those struggles are internal struggles, or having the courage to stand up to something. I guess, should I get into this? But the courage to stand up for something that isn't right. So sometimes it isn't you. So I don't want to be like, to gaslight everyone here, like it's always you. Sometimes there are things that aren't you? And so being able to stand up and speak truth to power without anger is a hard one. So when I was very early in my career, I had a lot of righteous indignation for when I saw things that weren't right and demanded change. But now I've learned that, you know, people feel quite confronted, especially people in senior leadership positions do feel responsible for what happens in their company. And when you confront them with truth, you have to do it in a gentle way, in a way that excuses them of culpability, because there is the chance that they genuinely don't know. Mm. And I think that is also hard to do. That's a learned behavior. And again, when you start talking about behavior, that's that behavioral leap, like understanding the position that people are in, and that if you actually want to drive change, you have to have empathy for the change agents as well.
Cool. Okay. So tell me what you love about your role.
What I love about my role is new challenges. I said earlier that I love novelty, and I love that every day when I come in, there's some new, I love problem solving, some new challenge to solve, and knowing that in solving those challenges, I'm going to help someone, which is great. A big part of my personal platform is, you know, I say this over and over again, leveraging the power of brands to help people. And so when you're a marketer, brands are giving you tens of millions of dollars sometimes to execute a campaign. The way you execute that campaign, who you choose to represent in your advertising and in your communications, the way you speak has an impact on culture, and it can have an impact on the way people view their lives, and that's power. And so learning that that's power and taking responsibility for that has felt really good, actually.
So can you tell me where you go to fuel your creativity, what you do, what you see, what you engage with?
Love a good thought walk. Oh, I love to meander aimlessly.
Thought walk. Love this. I have to say, you are American, obviously. It's so American. You're not going on a walk. You're going on a thought walk.
Thought walk. There's got to be an intention. Yeah. There's got to be a reason. But yeah, like having a meander, going in and out of shops. Actually, on the way here, I passed a bookstore and grabbed this great book about the secret communication that plants have with one another. And I'm excited to dig into it. Love nature. I love a visit to Kew Gardens. Oh, it just brings me so much joy just to put my feet in the grass, have a think. And the answers come to you. It's like it's sort of like that bathtub moment where that's when the inspiration comes to you and you're like, oh, I get it. This is the answer. And so you need that. You can't always be chasing an answer. Yeah. Sometimes they come to you.
Yeah, Kew Gardens is beautiful, isn't it? Mm. Have you been to Hampstead Heath?
Not yet. Everyone keeps saying.
Oh, my God. I think you'll really love that.
Okay. Have a wild swim.
Yes, in the ladies' pond.
There's a ladies' pond.
Oh, yeah, there's a ladies' pond. So no man can come in. It's all been, like, manicured. It's Victorian so that no one can see in. So it's yeah, to hide your modesty.
I will do that.
It's very nice. Don't know if now's the right time. Maybe wait for the summer. But it's beautiful in the summer because what you get is just all these, like, sounds of women's voices. And it's like a different pitch, isn't it, when it's just women? Like, and so they're all kind of sitting around, people having picnics, and then people are swimming, and it's beautiful. I think that's for you.
Amazing, yeah.
And there's a beautiful cherry tree that comes into blossom in the spring over the pond. It's so nice.
So I love memes as well. Like, so there's a account I follow called Beige Cardigan I'm obsessed with, and one of the memes is, my personal aesthetic is Victorian ladies in paintings laying in the grass with their titties out. And I'm like, yes. So what you just described, here for it.
We're happy to share that with social media too, so send us pictures.
Okay. Will do.
Yeah. Cool. So coming to the end of the interview, I've so loved chatting to you. You're so like amazing energy and just, yeah, I love it. You're really fast speaking as well. So I'm like constantly like having to hang on every word you're saying. So before you go, can you tell me what you've got coming up in the next few weeks or months?
For sure. I think ready for another transformation. Mm-hmm. Speaking of business transformation, so I'm trying to transform my team and the remit of my team to be more centered around data creativity. And so really trying to unlock those go back to Africa ideas. And so, yeah, that's what I'm excited about. And obviously the book, getting that out there. Yeah.
That's awesome. So before you leave, something I ask everyone, well, it's two things I ask everyone, is there a career or job in the creative industries you know little about, you'd like to know more about? Potentially I could get a woman in that role on the podcast to talk about it.
It's like creatives. I know it's the thing that it just fascinates me. And I think they're so smart. And I'm always, and the different flavors of creatives, right? And so you tend to think of the creatives as like the monolithic duo of, you know, the copywriter and the art director. But I just met someone who was a creative strategist or a creative technologist, so like a woman who does something like that. I think would be
Creative technologists I've not had, so that's a good shout. Okay, I'm going to try and get that role. And the final question is there a woman in the creative industries that you would recommend that I get in touch with and invite her on to Greater 11%?
Nikki Bullard. So there are loads of people, like any of my peers. So I am lucky. So I work at a company right now where every single department head in the digital specialism is a woman, except for our comm strategist. And so I will recommend all of those. We have a woman who's our head of data analytics, a woman who's our head of MarTech. Very few women who do that, our head of social, our head of UX and experience design. But Nikki Bullard is our chairwoman. She's actually the person who posted about Wackle that made me sign up for it, which is how you and I came to meet. And she's just a powerhouse, and she's always doing things for women. She's our chairwoman and our chief creative officer, but I feel like she must have another title that is even grander. Yeah. She is our unicorn incarnate for our agency. So yeah, Nikki, if you can get her.
Okay, that would be great, for sure. Oh, thanks so much for coming on. I've so loved chatting to you.
Thank you. I loved chatting to you too.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed, please write a review and rate, as that helps other people find Greater Than 11%. Also, stay subscribed to keep up to date on the weekly releases.